From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in the Rochester City School District, which is among the districts grappling with how to handle school reopening. Rochester was a district that did it differently than most other public districts in Monroe County last year. A year ago, we were talking about 18 of the 19 opening with at least some in-person learning. Rochester waited. They wanted to make sure that things were safe, that there was data for safety, and a lot of that started to change in February. Well, now, what about what happens next month? A year later, the district is doing things differently than it did in 2020. Late last week, officials sent a letter to families informing them that beginning on September 8th, when school is back in session, the district will provide in-person instruction 5 days a week. Remote learning will only be offered to students approved for medical exemptions. Earlier this week, we had the chance to talk to the head of the teachers' union, the Teachers Association, Ed Murbanski. Today, it's a chance to hear from the superintendent, not only responding to some of what she heard in that conversation, but also responding to parents, students, and those in the community who wonder, how do we make decisions? What's the best path forward? How do you choose the least difficult option in a series of tough choices? Dr. Leslie Meyer-Small is with us, back on the program now, and it's always an honor to have her. Dr. Meyer-Small, thank you for taking the time to join us. How are you?
Evan, thank you so much, and it's always a pleasure to be on. I have to just start by saying I am, even though we have many things that are going on and changes, I am so excited to have all of our scholars, or the majority of our scholars, come back to in-person learning 5 days a week. I'm doing very well.
Well, and so let me just start right there. Your decision sounds very similar to some of the decisions we're hearing from other districts. For example, yesterday we had your colleague Kevin McGowan from Brighton on this program. They are also not offering a consistent remote learning option. And I asked him, how many parents have indicated to you as a result of that they're going to hold their kids out and homeschool them? His answer is one so far. He expects to hear more, but the answer so far is just one. How many of you heard from families that say, well, we're not going to send our kids to school then?
I can tell you the number of requests that we've had for the medical exemption, and that's 10. But as far as the homeschooling, I don't have that number.
Do you expect it to be a substantial number?
I don't.
Talking to Dr. Leslie Meyer-Small this hour. And listeners, if you've got questions, comments, you can communicate with the show in various ways. You can give us a call. You can certainly email the program, connections@wxxi.org. And I know a lot of parents have been wondering about, just how Delta makes things different, et cetera. So if you could, Dr. Meyer-Small, the first thing I'd like you to do is just kind of walk us through what school will look like next month, starting September 8th, and what you've decided in terms of in-person, masking, vaccination, et cetera.
Thank you, Evan. So if students are getting on a school bus, they will be required to have a mask. So we are applying universal masking throughout the entire district, whether you're on a bus, whether you are inside or outside. Again, the only time with universal masking that it is pulled down if you need to take a mask break or if you're going to eat or drink during lunchtime or breakfast. Once students come to school, they will enter in through the varied entrances, and they will the goal is to ensure that our staff are just welcoming them, because one of the things we have to be very mindful of is the trauma and the adverse childhood experiences, and just certainly the trauma of being some of our scholars not being in school physically since March 13th. So creating that welcoming environment, welcoming Evan and Leslie and Medisol back to school. And then we will have certainly ample PPE, which includes masks should it break, should a student lose one. We also will have hand sanitizer all over the building. We will have supports as far as social-emotional supports to make sure that scholars, if they have things that they are experiencing, they've experienced, that they have someone to talk to. But we, like the other districts, and I'm sure Dr. McGowan shared this, we're following very closely the CDC guidelines that very first The very first piece of the recommendation says students benefit from in-person learning and safely returning to in-person instruction in the fall of 2021 is a priority. So I know that that's the priority of myself and my other colleagues in Monroe County. We also are, since I have this opportunity, we know that vaccination is an individual choice, but I'm highly encouraging individuals to get vaccinated and my scholars who are 12 and up to get vaccinated. If they have not been, I'm vaccinated. My family is vaccinated. And we know that children under 12 can't be are not eligible for being vaccinated at this time. So if you, again, you go back to that guidance, they emphasize the importance of layering, and that is vaccination, masking, to make sure that everyone can stay safe.
We had a listener yesterday ask a question that I would like to relate to you. The listener was asking if you agree with some of the conclusions that we have heard drawn about the impact of fully remote learning in the last 18 months on students, with some analysts saying it's the equivalent of a loss of a full year of learning for students. Do you think it is that detrimental?
You know, I think it really does vary, because we have to understand that some of our scholars reacted very well to remote learning and thrived in that environment. You know, we have online opportunities for particularly secondary students, but I think some did well. Some were moderately impacted, and I think some were certainly significantly impacted. When you are mindful of some of the more vulnerable populations, if a student had a disability or a student who was bilingual, that might have been much more difficult. But even when you look at students, we know just in general, they react to school very differently. The way that I performed in school versus the way my sister performed in school was very different. And, you know, we were in the same household with the same set of parents. So that's what's going to be really important as they come back to school, is to assess and to see where they are as far as their learning. And just to reiterate, we're not calling it learning loss. We're saying we have scholars who have unfinished learning, because we want to take a strength-based approach, Evan, to this. Because while they may not have gained some of the academic areas, each one of our scholars learned something and gained different skills through the experiences that they had being remote.
Does that mean, with unfinished learning as sort of a framework for how you see it, does that mean that you have to supplement what would be a typical school year with additional learning opportunities, whether that's looking ahead to next summer and summer school or anything else during the school year?
Yes, absolutely. But we did start this summer with dealing with unfinished learning, and we have students that participated in summer school. We had about 3,300 participated. But we also partnered with the city of Rochester, because part of this dealing with the unfinished learning is the fact that we have to just get students re-engaged again, right? If we're going to get them to come back to school, they have to get re-engaged with one another, with their classmates, with their friends, and with adults. So we partnered with the city of Rochester, and we had students participate in activities. They were involved with Rochester Public Libraries in Monroe County. We have RCSD takes over, so we have scholars who are going to the Rochester Museum and Science Center, and they're going to go skating. So we're trying to just really get students to help transition them back to what we knew pre-pandemic.
To be clear on masking, it will not be an option, is that right, unless students are eating?
We're universal masking, everyone,
okay.
Students, adults.
So I want to ask you to respond to two things that are at the top of my mind here.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned on this program earlier this week, I'm looking at NBC News reporting out of Tennessee. One of the wealthiest districts in Tennessee had a school board meeting mm-hmm. and a public forum the other night, a couple nights ago, and hundreds of people attended. There was a spillover crowd outside. Doctors and health leaders testified there why they think there should be mask mandates. Mm-hmm. A group of parents followed them outside, heckled them, screamed at the doctors. One man told the doctor, "You'll never be allowed in public again." Another followed a doctor to their car and said, "You can leave freely, but we will find you." These people were I mean, boy, very angry. And that conflicts with what we heard this morning on the Today Show when next governor, the governor-to-be, Kathy Hochul, talked to Savannah Guthrie on the Today Show. And Savannah asked Kathy Hochul about mask mandates from the state level down, from whether it's state ed or state health, saying, you know, to districts, you ought to do this. She said there's only one governor at a time. She's not the governor yet. She wants to respect that process. And Savannah said, right, but we think, you know, time is of the essence, and we think it's important to know where you stand on this. Do you think that there will be state guidance on masking? And here is what Kathy Hochul said.
I believe that they'll end up being mask mandates. I just don't have the authority at this moment. In fact, I'm meeting the health commissioner in a couple of hours to go over this, and I'll be drawing on all the current data that's available, CDC recommendations, but also we need to be talking to the school districts as well. That hasn't happened in the past, is the way I think it should. We need to find out what their anxiety is, why there's any objection to this. And I believe that this is going to have to be the way we go to make it a safe environment for everyone to feel we get back to school. And that is my number one priority. Children have to be back in school. We cannot have this continuation of this hybrid or work from home situation anymore if we can avoid it. But again, these decisions that I'm talking about today, or my opinion today, may have no bearing if this variant spirals out of control. I'm watching those numbers like a hawk, and we'll have metrics that determine when we take a different course. We'll be flexible. There will not be a decision made now that may even hold in a couple of weeks, because I don't know what the variant is going to do or any new variants. But that is the job of a governor, to make sure that we have that data and make the right decisions for New Yorkers.
That's Kathy Hochul just this morning. So she believes that there will be a mask mandate, but she can't say for certain. She's not the governor yet. A lot of districts are taking it upon themselves to do this. Have you had any pushback, Dr. Meyer-Small, on this issue?
I have not. We, meaning myself and my cabinet, met with the union presidents from all four unions, including other members of unions, and we had a good conversation, and that literally was at the top of our list. And we were all in agreement that that was critically important. I shared that certainly we weren't going to mandate vaccination, but masking would be universal, and they were very, very supportive of that, coupled with testing of both students and staff. But they were supportive of the universal masking. We know that from locally, Dr. Mendoza has said this. We've heard it at the state level, and we've heard it through those CDC guidelines, as well as the American Association of Pediatrics, that masking is a huge deterrent in not only preventing the spread, but also keeping folks safe and from catching it or transmitting it.
Yeah, I mean, if we're just looking at where the loudest opprobrium has come in terms of masking, it's generally white suburban communities, it's rich white people, it's conservative white people. I mean, that's mostly what it has been, and it's mostly adults and not kids. Kids have handled it pretty well. I'm not, you know, sort of trying to poke at this issue. I'm just actually trying to analyze where a lot of the anger is.
Sure.
And I don't think kids want to wear masks forever, and I don't want kids to wear masks forever. Do you think, Dr. Meyer-Small, that if we get to a point where we end up with 5 years old and up getting vaccinated soon, which could come in the next month, could come in two, whatever. I mean, it could be very soon. Or even people of all ages getting the option to vaccinate. Will that mitigate the need for masking?
I don't think so. No, I think it just helps to continue to keep individuals safe. And again, through those CDC guidelines, they talk about layering, vaccination, masking, social distancing. So I think that just only helps to increase the numbers of individuals who stay safe and who are not infected and don't transmit. But right now, because that Delta variant is so unpredictable, the more that safeguards that we can put in place, I think just the safer we will be.
We'll get to vaccines in a moment here, but let me grab a phone call from Sister Beth from St. Ambrose Convent in Irondequoit on the phone. Sister Beth, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm really calling fresh from a meeting yesterday of the Interfaith Committee of the Children's Agenda. And there are two questions that I was going to pursue. And behold, I found out that the superintendent's on right now. So the first question is in regard to the unfinished education. Would it be helpful to see if we could call forth from the faith community and other places volunteers that would be trained to help supplement anything and what was needed in terms of this unfinished education, which is unfortunate? And then the second question is what mental health supports are going to be put in place for the children? Thank you very much.
Yeah, very good questions. Thank you, Sister Beth. So let's start with the first question. She's asking, do you need volunteers from the faith community helping trying to fill in the gaps of unfinished education?
So, Sister Beth, thank you for those two questions and agreed with Evan. Wonderful questions. So that's a delicate balance because as we add more visitors to the school, right, we have to be mindful of that. And that's, Evan, one. So certainly it's all hands on deck, and we want everyone who is able and willing to help our scholars and our staff with the unfinished learning. But we have to balance that with making sure that if we do have visitors in the schools, that they are either vaccinated or participating in testing and that they're wearing masks. So that's something that we still are wearing out, not adverse to having support, but we need to monitor that, especially as the levels rise. And then as far as the social-emotional supports that are put in place, we have been very mindful of that in the Rochester City School District. Pre-pandemic, we know that our scholars have been impacted by ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. We've had Daniel Prude that has happened in our community, and that has impacted our scholars and our staff very directly. And then you put on top of that the impact and the trauma of being sequestered away, not being able to connect in person with their peers and their friends and their teachers. So our Division of Student Support Services has been hard at work over the past several months and in very much so a concentrated way over the summer. So certainly we've worked on fortifying the professional development for our counselors, our social workers, and our psychologists. We have our Rock Restorative team. But where we are really pivoting and making the shift is that social-emotional learning is everyone's job in the Rochester City School District. And while I recognize my training is in school counseling, so I'm very comfortable with that, and others might not be, but just, again, just that inclusivity and that welcoming. So when our scholar gets on a bus, welcome, Evan. So excited to have you on the bus. We're going to have you there in about 20 minutes. As soon as they get dropped off, walking into the school environment and having that be very encouraging and loving and kind, and then as they either in a class all day if they're elementary or if they're moving between classes. So there are just simple strategies that we can use that help to support our scholars. But yes, that is definitely a focus. And we have community organizations and agencies who are working with us, who've worked with us in the past and have are uplifting the fact that we need to do things a little bit differently because students have been sequestered away in some instances.
Okay, and now on the subject of mental health, Adam Urbanski weighed in on that too, and his feeling is that the RTA's position is that the district has not invested enough in support services and support staff to help students with the mental health impacts of the pandemic from the last 18 months and going forward, and that is an investment the district must make. What do you say to that?
I agree that we need to invest in supporting our young people through mental health supports. And that was actually a conversation that we had with all of the union presidents, including Adam. And we walked through what our mental health plan is. That, again, it is everyone's job, but we are fortifying our social workers, our school psychologists, our school counselors. We have added some additional staff, and through the American Rescue funds, we've had principals make requests for fortifying. So what we're doing is we've looked at every single school, and the principal is the chief executive officer of their respective schools. They need to see where they are as far as what supports and are there additional temporary supports that could be put in place. So that's something that we're not adverse to, and we certainly will continue to look at that.
And one more question before I get back to some phone calls on the subject of what else the RTA was asking for. They said that class sizes are too large, that we need to spread kids out more, and we need to therefore probably hire more teachers and more staff to account for that. What do you think about that?
So I heard that concern, and that was uplifted in our meeting. But again, going back to the CDC guidelines, they're saying maintaining at least 3 feet where practical. But when it's not possible, that the focus really is getting students back. One of the things that I'm just very transparent about, and I've shared it, is that our attendance is not where it should be. So whereas we have students who are assigned to a particular teacher, it's not 100% attendance in those classrooms. So I believe that we'll be pretty close to observing that 3 feet. It won't be universal and standard across the board. But this is a problem that I'd like to have, frankly, Evan, that all of our scholars are coming and participating in the school day from start to finish.
Talking to Dr. Leslie Meyer-Small, who is the superintendent of Rochester City Schools. And by the way, on the subject of social distancing or physical distancing, I've said that I view that as a very good effort by the health community to try to find the right balance. It's sort of quasi-scientific. I mean, it's mm-hmm. It's not perfect. 6 feet early on was based on how far we typically expelled droplets.
Right.
3 feet indoors in classrooms was another one. But I'm not sure with Delta any of that stuff really applies anymore, does it? I mean, do we need to be scrutinizing what physical distancing is even still?
I think this is where the target is constantly moving, which adds to the frustration and the challenge of being a superintendent or working in a school system, is that Delta variant is so, we're still learning about the infection rates, how close you need to be. So that's why we need to constantly monitor, but that's why it's also so important for us to work in partnership with Dr. Mendoza, who has been a critical partner, essential partner for us, as well as our other medical professionals, particularly at the pediatric level, who have been helping us maneuver through this.
And last point on this, the Rochester Teachers Association says there's been an influx of federal and state money. There's tens of millions of dollars. You've got the money to hire more teachers, and you should do it. Is that true?
It's true that we have an influx of the money, but we are have certain guidelines that we need to follow that governs those monies. But we also have a state monitor and approval that has to go through. As I shared earlier, Evan, some principals have requested for additional staff, which include mental health and other. We're reviewing those requests. But again, I just need to be very clear that would be on a temporary basis, that it's from 2 to 3 years. We also have to be mindful of the fact, we don't like to talk about this, but the enrollment in the Rochester City School District is declining. So I have a responsibility with everyone, all stakeholders, including the union, the board, our families, to look at that and to make sure that we are staffing at the appropriate levels. That's a reality that we do face. The enrollment is declining.
Okay, and this is a point that I wish I would have considered when I was talking to Mr. Urbanski, because I think what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is yes, there's an influx of federal and state dollars, but that is not going to, that is a one-time sort of spigot of funds. That's not going mm-hmm. to be there every year. So if you raise what your annual outlay for the budget's going to be, and eventually that funding isn't there to cover it, then you're in trouble. Is that correct?
It's called the financial cliff,
okay.
And we do not want to create that.
Okay. It's a fair point. And if I were sharper, I would have asked Adam about that, but we'll get around to that in another conversation. Let me go back to the phones. This is Kim in Rochester. Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have one comment and one question. My comment is I'm really happy to see the kids going back in the fall. I live in the city, and I talked to some of my children neighbors, and they were really kind of sad and lonely this year. It was hard for them, very hard for these poor kids. And my question is, as you know, when the kids did start going back and they were having the lunches in the schools, there was a lot of attention given to the fact of the poor quality of the lunches that they were being served. I mean, it was actually sounded pretty awful. And so I want to make sure, or I want to ask if that's being addressed, and if with this influx of dollars that's coming into the district, if it's going to be a better year for the kids from a food standpoint. Are they going to get nice, nutritious, attractive food this year instead of just that stuff that they got at the end mm-hmm. of last year?
Okay. Superintendent Meyer-Small?
Sure, Kim, thank you for that question. When we met with our union representatives the other day, we did address that. And Mike, who oversees our operations, did speak about the fact that we would be shifting. We do have to be mindful. We still do have a little bit of a staff shortage, but the meals are improving. And with our scholars coming back, you know, we are able to do that. We will absolutely have hot meals at the secondary level. We're going to install salad bars into some of our schools. So that definitely will be improving. We know that that was concerning it was concerning to me as well as our school community and those looking in.
Okay, thank you, because they really depend on that food, too. That's something that they depend on every day. So thank you.
Completely understood. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. 844-295-TALK. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Your colleague from Brighton told us that he was amazed at how well teachers performed in hard circumstances in the last year and a half, creating remote learning plans in Rochester, Brighton, Greece. I mean, every district. I mean, teachers went above and beyond to do their very, very best in hard circumstances. And he said, you know, they really did ultimately pretty well with that. And I asked him, I said, if that's the case, then why not also offer a remote learning option for families, for parents, for students who are uncomfortable with the idea of being back in the classroom, especially before widespread vaccination is available? Do you feel that remote learning should have at least been afforded as an option here, Dr. Meyer-Small?
Another good question, Evan. I do believe that it should be an option, but I think we have to take a look at who are the most optimal students to participate in that so we can maximize their learning and they actually move from one grade level, one marking period to the next, one level to the next, and one grade level to the next. And so this being in a remote environment does give us an opportunity to innovate and engage. But to just say, without having some parameters put in place like attendance, because if you're not engaging with remote learning and you're not coming on and participating in the assignments, you should not be able to participate in remote learning, right? I also think that there should even be a certain, you know, a grade level. You need to be passing the course. So that is something that I'm looking at as we move, and I'd like to I'm putting together a document for a virtual academy that we could move forward in the future with the district. So I'm not adverse to remote learning, but to just wholesale say if you're interested in remote learning that you can participate, we need students to be successful in the remote learning environment. So I think with some additional parameters, and if we are able to successfully petition and get approval from the state, absolutely would like to open that up. I recognize unequivocally that we have parents and caregivers who are very fearful to send their children back to school. But again, that's why I'm trying to get out, and thank you for allowing me to be on today, to get the word out that we will have the PPE in place, the systems and structures so that we can keep students safe. Now, with that said, with what Lieutenant Governor Hochul said, that with things changing, we might have to pivot. So I have my Department of Teaching and Learning also working on the fact that if we do have to quickly shift to remote, and it probably will happen on a school-by-school basis, and what might determine that if we have bus drivers that get infected and we don't have enough to cover with subs to bring students to school, or if we have teachers or other staff that get ill, then we're going to have to shift to remote learning on a temporary basis until things calm down and get to respectable levels. And that's my hope that will come out, that we'll know what is it that's the what's the trigger point, if you will.
Yeah.
Where we would shift, right, to being remote. And that's why our Department of Information Management and Technology is so critical. And again, as you talk about the dollars, we're making sure that we have additional Chromebooks. We're making sure that we have book bags for students to bring their devices back and forth if we quickly have to make that pivot. And we really have ample MiFi devices, so that's not an issue or problematic. But we recognize that we may have to shift, and we're getting prepared for that as well.
Yeah, it sounds to me, though, at this point, it's not a situation where that shift comes if it's 100 cases, 50 cases, mm-hmm. 10 in a school. That number doesn't exist right now. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so that guidance is still coming. Talking to Dr. Leslie Myers-Small, the superintendent from Rochester City Schools, and on the other side of this break, we've got a few more emails from listeners who are just asking about, sort of daily health checks and who's responsible and how we make sure we're tracking COVID. We've learned a lot in the last 18 months. Temperature checks can be maybe a little helpful. They're not the be-all, end-all that I think a lot of people thought at the beginning of the process. And so I'm curious to know if that's still going to happen or who's responsible for that. So we'll talk about that and a lot more with the superintendent who has the very, very challenging job of helping lead a district that will be opening 5 days a week in person, barring something very strange in the next 4 weeks. School is coming back in person in Rochester, and we're right back with the superintendent next. Coming up in our second hour, speaking of education, let's get outdoors. A new organization called Rochester Ecology Partners is hosting a symposium on the subject of nature-based education, getting kids outdoors to learn, to explore their environment, to do more experience-based learning during this pandemic, yes, but also beyond. And we'll discuss it next hour.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Superintendent Leslie Myers-Small, Dr. Myers-Small, why not mandate vaccination for your teachers and staff?
That's a personal choice at this point, right? I have enough regulations, Evan, frankly, that I need to deal with, and vaccinations are a personal choice for each individual. What I have jurisdiction and responsibility is to make sure that the environment is safe. So I want folks to ensure the universal masking, so that is input, and I'm highly encouraging, strongly encouraging, by word and deed, that individuals get vaccinated. But I'm not, that's not really my wheelhouse to mandate that.
You know, on the subject of personal choice, I mean, if I want to eat Snickers bars for dinner for the next 10 years, that's a personal choice that will impact my health. Sure. But if I'm not vaccinated, that may be a personal choice, but it can impact others, right? I mean, doesn't that take it beyond the realm of just personal choice?
It does impact others, and so that's why I'm so grateful we have other measures like masking to put in place. But, when it comes to the medical arena, that's not my wheelhouse. It's quickly become, I've learned a lot about it over these past 18 months, but that I feel that is a personal choice.
Okay. Jessica is a district parent who writes in to say, question about health screenings at home and attendance as far as when to keep kids at home out of an abundance of caution. Clear parameters and expectations would be helpful for parents, i.e., they have a runny nose. Should we send them or keep them home? Runny nose could last a week. Will the expectations for attendance adapt to compensate for the need to keep children home out of caution? It's from Jessica.
Another great question. We are creating a family guide that articulates that information because our expectation is going to be that families do take the temperature at home and do participate in a quick health assessment, just like when I was growing up, my mom would say, "How are you feeling today?" And so we need to really encourage our parents and caregivers to regularly practice that in the home. We want our families to do temperature checks every day, Monday through Friday, before scholars come. We want to also ensure that they're practicing masking, right? Because some of our scholars have not participated in that yet with some regularity. So we want to make sure that they're practicing that and incrementally moving from 15 minutes, adding an additional 15 minutes or half hour. So we want parents to assess their children daily, and we have some questions that will be in this parent guide. Have you been in close physical contact in the last 14 days with anyone who has tested positive? And then have you tested positive? So we will need to have those. Parents are going to have those conversations. We recognize that it's not perfect, and not every parent will remember to do that, but that's something that we really need to uplift. When we have our parent forum on Saturday, August 21st, it will provide an opportunity to collect some feedback and to have conversations with our parents and caregivers, and I'm working with our parent leadership team, the Executive Council, PLAC, to see how we can make sure that we are encouraging families to have this be a regular part of their repertoire, as well as our Office of Parent Engagement.
All right, Ray Ellen in Rochester, next on the phone. Go ahead, Ray Ellen.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call. I just wondered what the schools are doing about optimizing ventilation, since this has been shown to be a very effective way of decreasing the virus level in a space.
Great question. Dr. Meyer-Small.
Thank you. Again, our operations department has been ensuring that we have those appropriate MERV filter levels, and they have a schedule of when to replace those. So that is a check and balance that we have in place that will happen with regularity. Certainly, if windows can be opened in cases, we will do that when the weather is agreeable, but we rely very heavily on that, the MERV filters, and we are following that, and that has been in place from last school year.
And so you're running those filtration units continuously?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks very much, because that is a really critical way of reducing infection from this kind of virus.
Very good. Yeah, Ray Ellen, thank you. And I know that that has been one that's been top of mind for a lot of people in the district. So I think that perhaps the answers here today might be comforting on that score. Another listener asks, with a teacher and staff shortage, what is your plan for obtaining substitute teachers? Last year, fewer substitutes were needed compared to typical school years. And with most staff and students returning, there will be a need for staff to have substitutes due to the need to quarantine themselves or their own child on occasion.
So we have a great human capital department. That's our human resources. And Dr. Miller has been working on a substitute plan to ensure that he's recruiting folks to substitute. We'll have to obviously continue to monitor that to ensure that we have ample individuals to come in. But that's we are looking at a substitute plan and making sure that we have individuals who can come in should individuals be sick or have to quarantine or have symptoms.
Is contact tracing still something that either the district or the county is in? I'm not as up to date on contact tracing. Is that happening?
That's through the county, and we're waiting to hear those if the guidelines are the same or the process is the same or if they will change for 21-22.
Okay. Is the district involved, and forgive me if I missed it, in any sort of regular testing, whether PCR or rapid testing, and whether that's teachers or students based on different conditions?
Yes, we still will be involved with that. We're looking at, we have a partnership right now with Walgreens, which is in place, and that's through September 30th. We are working with them to see of the possibility of that being extended. But testing really, really is critical, particularly if you are not vaccinated. That testing is going to be essential to know if you've been infected or not.
Another listener on that subject is asking, what will be the RCSD threshold for quarantining a classroom if there are multiple cases of COVID?
Hasn't been determined yet. We're working on that with the county, with Dr. Mendoza. That conversation has come up as recently as this week, but we don't have because there are so many different factors that are involved with that. But we work very closely with Dr. Mendoza because we did have to make that decision last year. So that's where the district working in partnership with the county comes into play.
Can you look ahead and give me, and this is not, you know, sort of meant to be sort of doom and gloom. I'm curious to know what you think the best case and the worst case scenario is. And when I say worst case, I'm talking about what you may have to do to pivot or shift or unknowns. I mean, in your own mind, I'm sure you go over a lot of different scenarios to try to be prepared. Is there a best case and a worst case for this particular school year?
Well, let me start strength-based. Let me say what the doom is, and then let me circle back with strength-based positive. So the best case scenario is that we have increased numbers of individuals who certainly get vaccinated. Again, can't mandate it, but I highly encourage that. The other component of the best case scenario is that we quickly understand how that Delta variant is impacting and that we're able to mitigate that. The worst case scenario is that we know that the Delta variant does impact young people, our children.
More severely, yeah.
More severely, correct? And so we need to make sure that the worst case scenario would be that we have just multiple numbers of young people who are infected, and so that would impact our ability. We would have to really fortify our remote plan, and so teaching and learning is working on that. But again, this takes everyone working together. This is everyone making sure that they are staying safe, that they're wearing their masks, that they get vaccinated if they have not already been, if that's their comfort level, and that we are not putting ourselves in situations that we're in small or large gatherings, unmasked, where it could increase the possibility of getting infected. Everyone has to play their part in this.
And on that subject of vaccination, by the way, we've had a couple of listeners who I think they heard you say that you don't feel it's in your purview to mandate vaccination. Mm-hmm. But I think, and I will stress the point again, I think I've heard you say multiple times that you do recommend it, that you do want people.
I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. I'm vaccinated, and my immediate family, all of my immediate family is vaccinated. But I believe that that's a personal choice. The personal choice certainly has impacts that if you are infected and you are around in the school community, it will impact. So that's called personal response, your personal choice, but your personal responsibility. But no, I am not comfortable mandating masks.
Okay, so no mandate, but yes, a recommendation for listeners who are confused on that point. And we could see within weeks, I mean, maybe I'm being optimistic, but I think we could see it real soon, especially with the American Academy of Pediatrics leaning on the FDA and the decision makers to approve vaccination. I guess whoever the decision makers are, to approve vaccination for kids at least 5 and up, and maybe kids of all ages. We know that this has been in testing and in trials for months and months and months now, and some leading doctors have already said they think there's plenty of data to green light this now before most schools are back in session. Do you stay out of that, or do you find yourself thinking, let's go here, let's get the 5 and up green lighted?
I think that would be wonderful if that could happen. One of the things that I've been very cognizant of, Evan, though, is that there is some trepidation in Black and brown communities when it comes to vaccination. You know, I've been working with Wade Norwood and others to really get the word out, the medical community to get the word out. But when you have the history of the Tuskegee experiments that is not very far away from where we are right now, you have individuals who are absolutely concerned about the possibility, about getting vaccinated. So where it shifts into to my wheelhouse, I have a responsibility to partner with Common Ground or with our pediatricians to make sure we inform and educate, but most importantly, we are listening to what the concerns are and try to address those concerns. But I think it is important for as many individuals, including our youngest scholars, to get vaccinated. And we have held clinics in the Rochester City School District towards the end of the school year for students.
Yeah, and if I could, I would really appreciate hearing your thoughts about how you engage with people who have different reasons for not being vaccinated, because I think it's important to remember it's not all sort of a culture war. you know, I voted one way, therefore I'm never getting a vaccine sort of thing. People have a lot of different reasons. And as you say, in black and brown communities, you hear a lot of different reasons. Here's a short list of reasons I was given recently why people in predominantly black and brown communities have been saying no to the vaccine. Number one, not really urgent right now. Number two, doesn't think it will work. Number three, don't have time for it. Number four, still wanting to wait and see. Number five, don't trust the shot. Number six, worried it will interact with other medications they're taking. Number seven, God will protect me. I mean, those are probably things you've heard, and I'm curious to know how you sort of engage with some of that.
Well, I think first and foremost, it's, and this is the first step of what a good counselor does, is you listen more than you talk. And so you listen to hear, what are those concerns? Is it coming from a health and safety perspective? Is it coming from something with a bad experience? Is it coming from a religious perspective? Because I've heard the God will protect me and take care of me from acquaintances locally and in other states. And so you listen, and that's why you have the power of the medical professionals who can explain it in a way that says, here's what, when you're vaccinated, here's what the vaccine does, right? Here's how it protects you. But I think if you come in like gangbusters and you're like, you need to get vaccinated, that's not any way that you're going to convince someone who is steadfast in their belief, right? It may reinforce, this is exactly why I don't want to get vaccinated, because you're not hearing me out. But you have to listen through and try to waddle through that, and then just have a conversation. But in the final analysis of all of this, if someone is steadfast in this and they're not going to change, then we have to respect that. But then that's why we put precautions in place, like universal masking, because we know that individuals, some will not get vaccinated.
I understand. And on the subject of cases here, I just want to clear this up, because a couple of people have emailed about this. You know, there's this idea that we're only talking about cases. We're not talking about people who are actually ill. And I think it's important to point out that in places with high vaccination uptake, look at the UK. Their case numbers are finally starting to go down, but their hospitalization and death rates didn't get anywhere close to where they were last winter, because the vaccination has been remarkably effective.
Mm-hmm.
Same within Israel. And frankly, same in this country. We are seeing at least a bulwark against hospitalization and death to some degree. But this is a much more contagious version of COVID. This is the new baseline. We're not going back to the old vanilla COVID. I mean, the Delta is the new baseline going forward. That's why in Florida this week, they had 223 deaths from COVID 2 days ago. They're averaging 141 a day. Their record high is 180. They are close to their record high in Florida pre-vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
Their hospitals are overrun. I have friends and family members who live in Florida, and I know people in the medical community, and they come home in tears what they are dealing with. This is not just about case numbers. Now, thankfully, locally, we're not overrun with hospitalization, and that is a good, good scenario to try to keep. And I'm happy that that is the case, and hopefully that'll be the case going forward. Hopefully it's the case going forward that kids continue to do well with COVID. That's what we hope.
And
we're not going to try to over-scare people. I'm a parent myself, and I'm not necessarily scared about the idea of my 9-year-old getting COVID. I don't want him to, but I'm concerned about where it could go if he gets it. So it's about sort of efforts to protect everyone in the community without shutting down life. You heard the superintendent say, we're not closing schools. We're not shutting down schools. We have to, and I guess I'll close with this, Dr. Meyer-Small. Do you feel, given everything that we've now learned, you know, COVID is going to be endemic. There's no zero COVID. We're not getting rid of COVID. I wish we could, but all the experts say it's too late for that. It will exist in some form as long as we do. Is this the first step this fall towards just living among it, knowing we're not going to shut down society, we're not going to close all of our businesses, we're not going to close school, and we're going to welcome kids back? Is this a way to take that stride forward, knowing that that's what we have to do?
I agree. I remember first learning about COVID. I was in the state education department and watching how school districts across the state were responding. And there was a lot of fear because there was a lot of unknowns. And but coupled with that is that we know that individuals can either be can not show any symptoms. They can be mildly impacted. They can become severely ill to the point of death. And I think that's what scares many people, certainly, is the fact that this kills individuals. It's killing adults, and this variant is has impacted our littlest ones. Mm-hmm. But in the face of fear, in the face of fear, it's important for us, and especially as an educational institution, to inform and educate. That's what we know how to do. So how do we do that? We make sure that we are working with our parents and caregivers and giving them the information, which we will do through a parent guide. We make sure that we are listening to what the concerns are and to the extent practicable and to the best of our ability that we respond and we uplift those concerns. We know that even though testing and vaccination, this totally is outside of our wheelhouse, Evan. I was just on with superintendents across the country with the Secretary of Education, Cardona, and you see that, and some school districts have opened down south and in other places, that it's fearful, but we have a responsibility to work together, to work with our medical professionals, to work with our elected officials, with government, to work with the Department of Health, to work with parents, to make sure that we can move forward in really meaningful ways, because the bottom line is that it really, right now, the best place for our young people to be, whether they're pre-K all the way through graduation, is to be physically present in school.
Dr. Leslie Meyer-Small, I'm going to say superintendent, we're out of time, but I am grateful for your time as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Leslie Meyer-Small. More connections coming up.